Live and local from the 237 Roof Studios in Upper Lafayette. We are Acadiana's sports station. 1037 The Game. KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time to step your game up.
Boy, you wouldn't know how to write your name if it wasn't set like locker.
It's Rap Game with RP3. Raymond Parts the Third.
One of God's own prototypes. A high-powered mutant of some kind never even considered for mass production. Too weird to live, too rare to die.
Want to interact? Call in at 337-706-0111.
We happy? Yeah, we happy.
RP3 is taking the mic and bringing you to the center of the sports world on Rap Game with RP3 on 1037 The Game and 1037thegame.com.
You just got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
Solid. I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
We about to act a fool on this one.
Get out the way, because here we come. Because here we come. Get out the way, because here we come. Cause here we come. Who that?
Who that?
Who that?
Who that?
Who that said it gon' be them Saints? Who that?
Who that?
Who that?
Who that?
Who that said it gon' be them Saints? Turn down for who?
Who?
Turn down for who?
Good morning, Acadiana. I am Raymond Parks III, your host for the Rap Game with RP3 right here on 103.7 The Game. You're home for the LSU Tigers. We're broadcasting, as always, from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Give us a call today on this jam-packed hump day edition of the Rap Game with RP3 by giving us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. You know, when we play Yin Yang Twins on this show, it's usually to celebrate something involving the New Orleans Saints. There was no game played yesterday, yet it very much felt like a victory for the Hoodats. Cody, are you in a celebratory mood this morning based on what happened, led by New Orleans Saints head coach Sean Payton and New Orleans Saints owner Gail Benson?
It's the best mood of the week to start the show. That is for certain, my friend. So, yes, I am in a very celebratory mood. It's one of those, you know, can't go back again type things, but it's okay. We're looking forward now. I can see clearly now the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my team's way.
Yes. Yes. The NFC Championship game will not be replayed. The results of that game will not be changed based on what occurred yesterday out in the desert. But in a major upset, the NFL owners passed rules yesterday at the owners' meetings in Phoenix to expand instant replay. It was such a big deal that Gail Benson congratulated head coach Sean Payton afterwards with a big hug out in like a hotel lobby. It was that kind of victory. If you haven't heard, here's your details. The NFL owners passed a rule on Tuesday would essentially prevent egregious officiating mistakes like the one that cost the New Orleans Saints a berth in the Super Bowl last season. Starting with this upcoming season, they're not even waiting. Starting in 2019, coaches and replay officials will be allowed to challenge called and non-called pass interference penalties like the one that Nickell Robey Coleman got away with when he essentially trucked Tommy Lee Lewis before the ball came in the final minutes of the NFC Championship game. Coaches are going to be allowed to challenge the calls and non-calls at any point in the game except the final 2 minutes. Here's the thing. During those final 2 minutes, a replay official assumes the responsibility of challenging those calls or non-calls. I'll come back to that point, because that's the only thing that does not make me want to start a second line down the street. During the final 2 minutes, the coach cannot throw the challenge flag for an egregious call. On a non-call, no pass interference was called, or pass interference was called. The replay official assumes the responsibility. That's the only thing that worries me a little bit because, once again, you're depending on the official to be properly trained, have the instinct to go to the replay, to challenge it, to make sure the call is right. But it is a step, a major step in the right direction, a bit of an upset. A lot of folks did not think that this was going to get off the ground this quickly, that it would take a year or two to even implement. But, boom, it's going to start in 2019 season. This is what Sean Payton had to say about the decision by the NFL owners to pass this new rule change. "It's a positive change," said Sean. "We think it is a good change." As Jeff Duncan's reporting with NOLA.com, he said the decision was an upset of sorts. "Most insiders and observers thought it would take at least another year of research to affect the change. But NFL coaches, led by, of course, Sean Payton, united behind the cause in the last few weeks and apparently lobbied owners for hours on Monday out in Arizona and presented a new proposal that ultimately was passed by membership on Tuesday afternoon." Sean further says, "I don't think it will impact the way we watch games," Payton said. "There's two more calls that we're going to work to get right, and I think that the room felt really good about that. It fits the system we know and our fans know." So, Saints fans, you got to feel good about this. That the type of unbelievably inept call, or lack of a call, as I dubbed the New Orleans no call, will not occur again. That blatant pass interference, that someone will have the responsibility, that someone will have the ability to make the right call in that spot. Now, will that help New Orleans this season as they try to make a Super Bowl run? I don't know. Maybe not.
I can almost guarantee you it's going to hurt the Saints at some point in the season. That's almost a guarantee.
So what you're saying, I love this. My man is the typical Louisiana sports fan. Even the silver lining, there's a rain cloud there. So Cody's already predicting. This rule change is not even 24 hours old. And my man's like, it's going to go against the Saints this coming season.
Mark my words, the Saints will lose at least one game this year because of this stupid little rule change. And Roger Goodell will kick his feet up and go, "That's what you want, Sean? There you go, buddy. Promise you.
You're already playing out the scenario in your head. It's the NFC Championship game again. And there's going
to
be
This time Goodell lets us get to the Super Bowl.
And it's going
to
be like 2:02. And the other coach throws the challenge flag. And the pass interference call is going to be called on the Saints. And they're going to be the ones flagged for it. It's going to set up a game-winning field goal.
I hate you so much, Roger Goodell.
If that comes. But see, I'm going to blame you. And Saints fans listening here to 103.7 The Game should blame you as well. Because you put that bad juju out in the universe already. That scenario is already out there. And if that comes to pass at like 10 months from now, blame Cody Schutz.
If that ends up coming to pass 10 months from now, I'm going to buy a damn lottery ticket.
So, NFL challenge, rules challenge, once again, a situation like the NOLA, no call will likely not happen again. But the only rub about it is, once again, the coaches can throw the challenge flag on whether it's what they believe a bad call for defensive pass interference or a non-call for pass interference, okay? But they're not allowed to do it underneath 2 minutes. And the replay official will have to be responsible for doing that. Cody.
Raymond.
Do you have faith that when it gets under 2 minutes, that the replay officials will have received proper training and will be due diligent in making sure that an egregious call like the one that happened against Tommy that did not get called against Tommy Lee Lewis, that the replay official will do the right thing and make sure to make the right call.
All right. It's like a two-part question, so I have two answers to that.
I'll
answer the latter part of the question first. Yes, I think the replay officials, if something like what happened to Tommy Lee Lewis happens again, then yes, they will make that call because that's just how obvious and how egregious and how out wide in the open that type of play was. So if something like that happens again, then yeah, I see them making the call.
Okay.
To the former part of your question about the training and this and that of the replay, no chance, no shot. I mean, if they're not going to train, they're not going to fully invest and train to the highest ability. There are officials that are literally on the field, like especially the guy wearing the white cap. If they're not worried about those guys, why would I think at all that they're going to go above and beyond training these replay officials? Like, to them, these are guys that could just watch YouTube all day, for as far as the NFL is concerned, in my eyes.
Fair points. As a diehard member of the Whodat Nation,
guilty as charged.
Does this take away any of the sting of the NFC Championship game loss? Any, just even yeah. if it's like zero, even if it's 0.0001%, is there any part of you that says, okay, well, this is the silver lining we've been waiting for? This, at least someone won't get hosed again.
So I'm saying the Saints will take the role of martyr here. That's fine. I mean, someone's got to do it. That's, unfortunately, the NFL has proven time and time again to be reactionary and not proactive.
That is correct.
So,
especially under Roger Goodell.
So with that being the case, and maybe unfortunate or not, that's how things are, someone has to have this happen to them in order for change to occur. I mean, a much more serious issue, but still in the game of football, it took, you know, too large of a number of former football, professional football players to grow old with brain damage and these things before football started to take a look at things. And so it just proving more that the NFL and football in general is going to wait around for something to happen before they make a change.
I want to hear from you there, Katie. And so give us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. We'll also throw, will be our first Twitter poll question of the day. Does this new rule change take away any
good
of the sting from the NFC Championship game loss?
I was hoping that's what you were going to ask, because that's a tough one. I'm curious, very curious to see. We've got 3 hours here. We'll look at it throughout the show, because I want to know in a three-hour span what the outcome looks like.
That is correct. So you can go to the 103.7 The Game Twitter account. You can vote, or you can give us a call and give us your opinion that way as well. When we come back here after this break, we're going to talk more New Orleans Saints news. They finally got the deal done for Jared Cook. The never-ending speculation can be now put to bed as a deal is done. Cook has been locked up as a member of the New Orleans Saints. We'll dive into that deal right here on The Wrap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game.
I think, you know, it gives us a threat opposite of Mike. You know, a lot of times where Mike lines up is opposite the tight end. We feel like we've got some good tight ends in the building that, you know, that we have roles and visions for. But I think Jared's got a unique skill set, and we saw a lot of good tape of him.
I love Sean Payton, but part of that quote he just had right there was an absolute hot-mouthed lie. We got some good tight ends in the building. No, you don't. No, you don't. You got Josh Hill who can block. As we saw in the NFC Championship game without Ben Watson, and then Josh Hill got banged up with his concussion, they got guys named Raymond Parch out there trying to catch the ball. And that's not a good thing.
Hey, for all you know, on that specific day, Jeremy Shockey, Boo Williams, Ben Watson, those guys may have been hanging out in the building.
I love Boo Williams.
They may have been hanging out. They're not on the team, but he said in the building. They may just be hanging out.
In the RP3 man cave, there's an autographed photo of Boo Williams and me getting my photo taken with Boo Williams.
I didn't want to name Jimmy Graham, and I was trying to think of like three great Saints tight ends, and I guess Jeremy Shockey by default has to be on that list.
First of all, Shockey, tough, also pro Hall of Fame.
Yeah, oh, no, absolutely.
Okay. So, yeah. You know, everyone loved Jimmy Graham, and he put up amazing numbers, but he was kind of soft, right? I mean, let's be real. Boo Williams, tough. Jeremy Shockey, tough. Josh Hill, tough.
Ben Watson, tough.
Ben Watson, tough. Jimmy Graham, soft. You saw what happened when he goes to Seattle and then is he still an all-pro?
No.
I didn't think so. Was he a product of the New Orleans Saints system? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And besides being a physically gifted guy, he's like that cat that you see that plays basketball, and that's what Jimmy played. And that's the other thing that frustrates me. Jimmy played basketball, and he was a post player. Why are you soft, bro?
Right.
Why are you – like, you look like you should be the biggest, baddest guy on the face of the planet. And when a 6-foot, 230-pound linebacker comes in on you, you get scared.
Could you imagine if he'd had to post up against, like, Kendrick Perkins?
Oh.
Or somebody would eat
Perk
his lunch.
Ate his lunch.
I mean,
Perk would have got in his head. That would have been the end of that.
He'd have retired on the court at halftime. I'm done.
I'm done. I don't want to face a guy like Perk.
But yes, if you notice what I did there, I turned the beginning of the Jared Cook segment into somehow about burying Jimmy Graham.
Well, bravo. I approve of this. We're on the same page. We're on the same page. So, yes, the deal finally got done. The Saints got their big free agent target of this offseason, considered by many to be the best tight end on the free agent market, Jared Cook. A bit of a journeyman who's got his career finally on track with a couple of productive years with the Oakland Raiders. He posted career highs this past year in catches, touchdown receptions, and yardage. He's 31 years old. It's only a 2-year deal, so that's beneficial for both sides. It's a 2-year deal worth a reported $15.5 million. That's according to Ian Rappaport of the NFL Network. I approve of Ian Rappaport. He has rap in his name. The contract includes $8 million guaranteed. Now, look, Cook's played 10 seasons. This is a veteran guy. Like I said, including the past 2 seasons with the Raiders. You heard what Sean Payton says. He gives him another threat opposite of Mike Thomas. He's coming off a year, 68 passes for nearly 900 yards and 6 touchdowns. And he was selected to his first Pro Bowl. His best game case came against the Rams, when he had 180 receiving yards, setting a Raiders franchise record for tight ends. He did play his first 4 seasons with the Rams. I do believe he was probably coached by Jeff Fisher. That would explain why he wasn't very productive. I just blame if there's a player that's inept offensively that played under Jeff Fisher, I always blame him. And I feel that's sound logic as well. And he went to Green Bay, and then he headed to Oakland. He's not missed a game the past 2 seasons. Knock on wood. So they get themselves a guy, and here's the bigger thing. Being able to have Saints wide receiver Cam Meredith agree to the pay cut that they did a few weeks ago and reducing his base salary freed up enough space to let them be able to sign Cook to the 2-year deal that they wanted to. Now, if you're the Saints, this is what you're going to trot out there. Mike Thomas on one end. Can't guard Mike. Top 3 wide receiver in the NFL? You can make that argument. Then you'll have Jarrett Cook at tight end. You'll have Alvin Kamara coming out of the backfield. Those are going to be your 3 top pass catchers for the Saints. Those are going to be Drew Brees' 3 top guys. I'm telling you right now, they will lead the team in targets and receptions this coming year, if all healthy. Those 3 guys alone is going to make it nearly impossible for opposing defenses to be able to do anything. Okay, are you going to double Mike? Okay, well, that means you're going to leave Jarrett Cook open across the middle for 10-yard receptions all day long. All day long. Alvin Kamara. Okay, well, let's say you have a linebacker that's going to shadow the tight end on a crossing pattern, and you have the safety help to go with Mike Thomas. Well, that's going to leave Alvin Kamara open down the sideline. Boom, screen pass, 25 yards. Those 3 guys alone, with number 9 throwing them the ball, formidable. The key for the Saints, And getting a guy like Cook helps them because they missed that pass-catching tight end. We all love Ben Watson, man of the year, great community leader, does things in the community that most guys don't do. Reminds me a lot of work done in that regard. But Ben wasn't all that effective this last year. This is his last year. He's retired. He got banged up towards the end. Drew does love having the tight end to throw to. And we talked about it earlier, jokingly. Jeremy Shockey revived his career. He looked like he was on the trash dump. He comes to the Saints, boom. They take a guy who only played 1 year of college football in Jimmy Graham, a big project, boom, made him into an all-pro. Ben Watson had his best year as a pro his second year in New Orleans. They know how to utilize the tight end position.
Makes you wonder what happened to Colby Fleener.
How did that guy flame out?
I know that's a discussion for another time, but that just, you were rattling off tight ends, and I was like, good point, good point, good point, and then it hits me, Colby Fleener.
If you saw Colby Fleener play in college at Stanford with Andrew Luck, you're like, these two guys have great chemistry. This guy is a legit tight end. And then you saw what he could do in Indianapolis, and you're like,
he is?
This guy. And then he got to New Orleans, man, and he just got in his head, dude. He had a couple of drops, and that was it. And then, boom, he was like a kicker with the yips. Yeah, that was the end of that.
Right. I digress for you, though.
The key for New Orleans, now that they got Cook, Michael Thomas, Jarrett Cook, Alvin Kamara, solidified the offensive line. If they can get improved production out of these four guys. This is why I don't think the Saints need to sign a wide receiver in free agency. This is why I don't think the Saints necessarily need to draft a guy. You got Michael Thomas, who you're going to lock up. That's going to be your face of your franchise once Drew Brees retires. You're bringing in Jarrett Cook. You got Alvin Kamara. You still can get some mileage out of Ted Ginn. Okay, he can be your slot guy. But if you get anything of improved productions from these three guys, Cameron Meredith, can he show the potential that the Saints traded for him? He's still a young guy. Tre'Quan Smith was a rookie last year out of UCF. And Kirkwood was a rookie out of Temple, undrafted. You have one of those guys step up as the slot receiver or step up as a number four, number five wide receiver for this team, the Saints will be absolutely unstoppable on offense. You got those three guys. You got your number one with Michael Thomas. You got Jarrett Cook now. You got Alvin Kamara. And you got Ted Ginn Jr. still. You just need Meredith, Smith, or Cookwood, two of those guys to step up and play improved football. You don't need to sign another wide receiver, including Dez Bryant. That's enough Saints talk for right now. We'll get more to that later. Coming up, LSU baseball lost another midweek game to a Southland Conference team last night. We'll dive into the Tigers' woes at the plate here on the Rap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game.
To that mid to upper 90s type fastball. This ball is well tagged. Duplantis is back battling the sun. He's against the wall. He leaps. Did he get it? Yes, he did. Antoine Duplantis going to the wall and then some. Climbed the ladder and pulled back an extra base hit.
And that was the lone highlight for LSU last night at Alex Box Stadium versus a struggling McNeese State Cowboys team. And the Tigers somehow found a way to lose again to a Southland Conference team at home in the middle of the week at Alex Box Stadium.
Ask me for a highlight of LSU at the plate. Ask me for one.
Cody, do we have a highlight of LSU at the plate last night? There it is. Yeah. The hitting woes continue for the Tigers. And I don't know, man. Like, it's just a little frustrating and fascinating at the same time. Look, the midweek games really don't mean all that much to the likes of LSU. We talked about that on yesterday's show. They tend to struggle because that's the time where you throw out guys, pitchers that you're looking to get back off of rehab starts, helping build their strength. A lot of times it's pitcher by committee. You lose a lot of your bullpen. And your lineup is you give some guys a rest or maybe only have them play half a game and you get some of your subs, some good reps. That's what the midweek games are traditionally always used for. The Tigers, for some reason, struggle with the Southland Conference, though, which is odd. They barely edged out Southeastern. Southeastern actually held a lead in that game late, if I remember correctly, earlier in the season, where LSU was able to pull off the 6-5 win. We talked about their 1-0 loss at Northwestern State a few weeks back, where they were shut out. They were able to edge out Nichols, the Colonels, the Fighting Colonels, or as I like to call them, the Fighting Gerald Grunigs.
The Colonels had, like, I think, 3 or 4 Colonel Crushers in that game, as Len Rollins likes to say.
Yeah. LSU pulled out the 5-4 win there, but yesterday, not so fortunate. 2-0 loss at home to McNeese. The Tigers have now been shut out twice in the last 3 games, and they've been held to 1 run or less in 3 of the last 4. Now, if you look overall at their schedule, and you say, well, Ray, they've scored double-digit runs more than a few times. You're correct. You're absolutely correct, they have. 12 runs, 17, 13, 17, 17, 16, 16. Well, that's impressive. But let's back that up for a second. Do you know who they scored those plethora of runs against? Those came against the likes of ULM, Air Force, Bryant, which I didn't even know was a college until this year, Southern University, Texas Southern, and Kentucky. Not exactly the Murderers Row New York Yankees. Okay. When they play better competition, LSU struggles at the plate. They were able to score 7 runs over the weekend against Georgia, but they were also shut out and held to 1 run. Against that 3-game series against Cal, which they took 2 of 3, they scored 4, 2, and 5. When they played Texas, 1, 4, and 6. When they play the better competition, they struggle at the plate. They do. When they play the inferior competition from the SWAC, from the lower divisions, even lower than the Southland Conference, they rack up runs left and right. As a team, they're only batting .274. Right now, heading into this weekend series at number 2 ranked Mississippi State and the Fighting Cowbells that will be in full force there in Stark Vegas, not only are they batting .274 as a team, they only have 3 guys batting over .300. Now, Zach Watson has overcame his early season struggles. He's leading the team with .361 batting average, followed behind by Josh Smith, .349, Daniel Cabrera batting .314, and then Duplantis is right there hovering around .300. He's been a little bit of a slump of late, Lafayette High Zone. He's batting .297. The next closest guy in their lineup that's even remotely close to .300 is batting like .260. Now, teams get into slumps. They do. And it's a long season. And losing those midweek games is not exactly that damaging. The legendary, the Sports Hall of Famer himself, Scooter Hobbs, tweeted this out last night saying that, you know, Clay Moffitt afterwards said, quote, if the 09 team or the 97, 96, 93, 91, 2000, any of those teams saw what happened tonight, they would be disappointed. We feel like at LSU we have a tradition. You don't play like that. That's what Clay Moffitt said after the disappointing game, which, by the way, there was a players-only meeting on the field afterwards. When's the last time you saw that from LSU, where they had a players-only meeting on the field after a loss? In March. Still March. Still got a long way to go in this baseball season. But Scooter Hobbs made a good point. He said, well, the 91, 93, 2000 teams all lost to McNeese as well. So they couldn't say much, and they turned out okay. I do believe what Scooter's saying, that you can still win a College World Series championship there. It's a valid point. Losing to McNeese or losing to Northwestern State is not the end of the world. But last night was by far the worst offensive performance for LSU this season in the 2-0 shutout. And now they enter the weekend having lost three straight, and they have to go play number 2 Mississippi State. And that's not the kind of streak you want to have heading into one of the premier teams, not only in your conference, but in the entire country. Cody, how do you feel about your Tigers right now, man, on the diamond?
It's I have a double brain when it comes to LSU baseball right now. What I mean by that...
So you're an X-Man. You have some type of mutant ability? Okay.
That's exactly what I mean.
All right.
But no, it's like this. Right now, as I sit, I'm very disappointed in LSU baseball, because it's that classic deal of the first, you know, however long few weeks of the season, the pitching was very subpar.
And, it was. And Zach Hess struggled mightily. People were questioning whether he was going to be a Friday night starter. I think he's answered that question, but continue.
But the hitting was kind of picking it up, especially in that Cal series where LSU had no business taking 2 of 3 in that series. But they did, because the bats came around in the clutch and they got good hits, and there you go. Now LSU, the start of SEC play, the pitching for a couple of weekends in a row has turned a corner and has been, Zach Hess stellar, everyone else much better. And yet now they can't seem to get wins on the road because they can't hit the ball. So that has me absolutely very worried. What I have also on my mind on the other side, though, is seasons in the past for LSU baseball where they have struggled even into SEC play, where all of a sudden at some point in April they flip a switch, for lack of a better term, and they go on a 20-something game win streak, or they win 25 out of 23 games, or they do something crazy and go on a run. So I still hold out hope that this LSU team can put it all together, because if we can see the pitching stay consistent like it is now or has been recently, the bats come around as well like they were at the beginning of the season, then boom, there you go. You've got a very dangerous LSU team. So all the potential is there, the highest ceiling in the world, but they are very much underperforming as far as from SEC play on.
And the other thing is that they're bad on the road so far, right? They're 1-6.
Right. And Kentucky, that sweep of Kentucky, you can crumple that up and throw that away, because that is meaningless. Kentucky is bad.
They are not a good.
Not good.
Not good this
they
year.
Are 0-6 in yes. SEC play. So 2 sweeps for the Wildcats.
So after losing a series, a tough series, where Paul Menary said it wasn't really a problem with the lineup, right? He said it was just excellent pitching that they had faced, and Georgia's a top 10 ranked team. That can explain what happened. And I agree partially to that. But there's something to be said about this team and getting shut out at home against McNeese. Now, maybe this could be the thing that kind of lights a fire underneath them, right? You have the players-only meeting. You get embarrassed at home by a Southland team. You fall down in the polls. It's gut check time, right? And maybe it was a good old-fashioned chewing that they gave each other out there in what appeared to be right field, where they had their players-only meeting. Mm-hmm. And maybe they get it together. Maybe they go into Stark Vegas and take 2 of 3, and then they can get right back on track, right? That's all it takes. It takes winning one of these road series against a top-10 team. They have an opportunity to do that this weekend, If they go in there and they take two or three, or if they sweep, well, then everything's right in the world for LSU baseball. So it'll be up to them, though. Oh, Cody. Yes, yes, Mr. Schutz, you have a question. Thank you for raising your hand.
Less of a question, more of just an observation. You know, maybe you can give your opinion on what you think this means, but they had a players-only meeting after the game, after an embarrassing loss like that. Going into the game, Lynn Rollins and Ben McDonald let me know that the reason DiGiacomo was playing left field and Daniel Cabrera was DHing last night was because with the Mississippi State series starting on Thursday, your midweek game, you've got a lot of untouchables, a lot of guys that maybe threw on Sunday in that game that won't be able to throw today if you want them to be available for Thursday if you need them in that opening game of the series. So Devin Fontenot, Todd Peterson, guys like that were untouchable in the game last night.
Correct.
So Daniel Cabrera DH'd because he was their emergency pitcher in case they needed. He threw at Parkview Baptist, they said. So in case they needed him because they had so many guys in the bullpen, Palminteri did not want to run out there. Daniel Cabrera was DHing in case they needed to put him on the mound. That tells me that going into this game, the team had a bit of an attitude to where, okay, we're good. We're gonna win this game. We're going to have enough to where, oh, if we need to throw Daniel Cabrera, we'll be fine. We'll throw Daniel Cabrera. We're not going to touch any of the guys in our bullpen. And you ended up getting shut out, and you lost 2-0. I think maybe the team...
To an average Mittany State team. Not even a good. This is not a vintage Cowboys team.
Right.
But David Berry told us this.
He said they were bad, basically, yesterday. He talked to you for 15 minutes, and it was basically saying McNeese is not good.
They're not a good team.
And so maybe, just maybe, with coach looking ahead saying we're going to keep Cabrera here just in case we need him, the team comes in with this attitude of like, oh, we'll be fine. We might even get to see Daniel Cabrera pitch tonight. How exciting. That could be fun for us. We get to pick on him and make fun. Ha ha. And then you get beat. That, for me as a player, I would need to talk to my guys and say, hey, what happened here today is unacceptable. The team attitude and morale going into the game is unacceptable. These types of things. You know, I don't know. Maybe they had a very lackadaisical attitude going into the game, and I think that could have planted a seed that then grew into a players-only meeting after.
And I think you also have, and you make a good point there, but I also think you have the veteran guys like a Duplantis, like a Zach Watson, like a Josh Smith that have seen this play out before, right? You know, remember, LSU was not going to even make an NCAA regional last year. Yep. And they had to turn it on late, like you said, in April to even get to the NCAA regional. So these veteran guys know that the window is very small and that you have to turn it around when you have the opportunity to do so. And I think what you saw yesterday after the loss, I think that's going to be a huge benefit to them moving forward. The leaders, the vets stepped up and said, hey, enough is enough. Stop messing around. We got to take every opponent seriously, and we got to get our act together. We are LSU, damn it. We're better than this. I think that was the message that was sent, and I think you're going to see a focused and extremely amped up top-notch performance from the Tigers this weekend. Whether or not that results in a series win against the number two team in the country, we'll have to wait to find that out. But I think the players-only meeting is a good sign, especially here towards the end of the March, kind of get them to refocus and get their act together, because they are not playing like a team that was ranked in the preseason as number one, number two, and had expectations of going to Omaha and playing for the College World Series. They are not playing like a College World Series team right now, and they have not for weeks. They got to turn it around. They still got plenty of time to do so, but... The best time to do that is now rather than later. We're going to wrap up the first hour of the Wrap Game with RP3 right here on 103.7 The Game after this break. Welcome back to the Wrap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parsh III, right here on 103.7 The Game, your home for the LSU Tigers. We're broadcasting live, as always, from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. You can give us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline. We'd love to talk to you. Cody will let you get through. As long as you're nice to Cody, you could get on the air. It's hit and miss, though.
We used to do a thing on the Alan Michaels show called Tough Call Screening Tuesday.
Oh, I remember listening to Tough Call.
Tough Call Screening Tuesday?
Oh, it was tough to get on those
days.
Have to
bring that back. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure there was days that I called just to BS, and you're like, no,
I ran you immediately.
You're like, you're out of here.
Come on.
Dial tone. That's what you
get. Come with that weak stuff. You're getting packed all day.
Just a reminder. Just a reminder that you can listen to LSU trying to make its run to the Final Four. It resumes on Friday as they'll be taking the court there in the nation's capital. In the Sweet 16, they'll be taking on the 2-seed Michigan State. You can listen to that game live right here on 103.7 The Game on Friday. 5:30 pregame show begins, 6 o'clock tip. So make sure to keep it live and local here.
6:10 tip. 6:09 if you want me to be super technical.
If you want to be super technical, 6:09:38.
Oh, I have 37 on my pair. I just checked that.
We started off this hour leading off with the Saints. The news about the NFL owners signing off on a rule change where coaches are allowed to challenge bad calls, pass interference calls, or non-calls. That's what you can essentially call the Saints rule. That does not allow them to challenge with 2 minutes and less to go in a game. That depends on the replay official, but it's a positive step in the right direction. Sean Payton, Gail Benson view that as a victory. We also talk about the Saints finally getting Jarrett Cook to sign on the bottom line, locked him up from that 2-year deal. And we dove a little deeper about LSU baseball losing to McNeese, having a players-only meeting, and the bats struggling at the plate. Cody, let's give the people the update about our Twitter poll question for the first hour.
Yeah, we asked if the NFL rule change allowing for that pass interference to be reviewed, does that take any of the sting away from the Saints' loss in that NFC Championship game last season? 14 votes early on within the first hour there. 79% say hell no. No, it's not. They do not feel better. It does not help at all. I'm in the minority here, I guess, but that's because I have to deal with it on a daily basis. I wonder how many people are seeing this Twitter poll and for the first time in months are actually thinking about this, saying, oh, yeah, oh, now I'm mad again. So if we ruined your Wednesday, sorry.
We talk to our good friend Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast every week.
I remember.
He still is not over that. Yeah. Okay. Our man Andrew, I always use him as kind of like a test. I kind of test the waters, and sometimes I'll tweet at her, sometimes I'll text Andrew, and I'll be like, hey, man. And his reaction, I'll be like, yeah, nah, people still aren't over that. Your Twitter poll question for hour number two, we're going to throw that up here shortly. You can make sure to go vote on that, is do you feel that the players-only meeting that the LSU baseball team had last night is going to provide the team with the necessary spark to get things right in the win column as well at the plate? So do you think the players-only meeting held by the LSU baseball team is going to provide the team with a much-needed spark? Make sure to go to the 103.7 The Game Twitter account, vote, tell your friends to vote, tag your friends in voting, bully them if you need to. Say, you got to vote. Shame them. Just shame them. Say, why aren't you voting in the 103.7 The Game Twitter poll question today? Come on, dude. Everyone's doing it.
Peer pressure.
That's going to do it for the first hour of this hump day edition of the Rap Game with RP3. When we come back, Raging Cajuns baseball. Dramatic win. Walk off homer. That's right. We're going to talk about their big win against Tulane last night there at the Teague. When we come back here on 103.7 The Game.
Live and local from the 237 Roof Studios in Upper Lafayette. We are Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time to step your game up.
Boy, you wouldn't know how to write your name if it wasn't set for like locker.
It's Rap Game with RP3, Raymond Parts III.
One of God's own prototypes. A high-powered mutant of some kind never even considered for mass production. Too weird to live, too rare to die.
Want to interact? Call in at 337-706-0111.
We have it. Yeah, we have it.
RP3 is taking the mic. and bringing you to the center of the sports world on Rep Game with RP3 on 1037 The Game and 1037thegame.com.
You just got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
Welcome to the second hour of the Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, here on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. You can give us a holler on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. If you're sweet to Cody Schutz, he may let you get on the air. Just saying. You have to be nice to the producer. If you're not nice to the producer, you will not get on the air. That's how Cody works, okay? You look at him, you're like, he's small. He's an innocent. He's just a young dude, laid back. No. There's a ruthless assassin inside of him, and he will ruin your day by not allowing you to get on the air. You'll take great enjoyment in that. Pleasure, even.
You're making a lot of assumptions here.
I'm turning you from babyface to heel as we speak on the show today.
I don't know if that works. I don't know if that we'll try. We'll try. Here in Lafayette, Louisiana, hawk.
First hour we talked the NFL rule change where you can challenge non calls or bad calls. The Saints wrapping up tight end Jarrett Cook finally got him to sign on the dotted line in LSU baseball's hitting woes. We'll talk more about those woes coming up in this hour at 7:32 when we talk to the voice of the LSU Tigers, Chris Blair. But before that, we're going to stay on the diamond, but we're going to be right here in the backyard. The Raging Cajuns had themselves a heck of a victory last night. Dramatic fashion, they win a game in walk-off fashion versus Tulane. And the Cajuns, look, the Cajuns needed this, right? They were 11-14 heading into last night's midweek game. They've struggled with consistency, whether it's the bullpen that has let them down or the lineup has not come through when they have had good pitching. They've been up and down. They lost to Tulane on March 20th, 7-3, and then dropped the series to App State over this past weekend. But they were able to pull off a 7-6 win over the Green Wave and did so in dramatic fashion. Freshman Colton Frank, first collegiate hit, his first hit of his collegiate career came as he blasted a solo home run over the left field wall there at the Teague, giving the Raging Cajuns the walk-off 7-6 win over the Green Wave. The walk-off homer was just the second of the season for the Cajuns, who improved to 12-14 and overall. And it's the first coming off the bat of since Oren Vaughn helped them win that game against Southern Miss in extra innings, 6-5 back on the 13th. It was not only Frank notched his first career hit in RBI, and he got the celebratory bath and I want to say pie in the face afterwards. Good job, Raging Cajuns. Doing it right. Got to keep those traditions alive.
It stings up the nose and the eyeballs.
Oh, yeah. The shaving cream. Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, it burns.
No, thank you. Barbasol.
Despite being out hit, though, 15-8. The Cajuns came through with the victory. Hayden Cantrell, he extended his hit streak to 14 games. By the way, yesterday, Hayden Cantrell, the former Turlings Catholic star, state champion, sophomore sensation for the Raging Cajuns, he was named not only the Sun Belt Player of the Week, he was also named the Player of the Week by the Louisiana Sports Writers Association. Then he goes out there, extends his hit streak to 14 games. Tremaine Spears and Handsome Monica also got some hits as well. So what do we take from this? The Cajuns needed this win. It's an in-state school. Somewhat of a rivalry there. But more importantly, after dropping a series at home that you shouldn't have against App State, you let that one slip through your fingers. You let that one get away from you. You've already lost to Tulane during a midweek game to begin with. You're under 500. March is almost wrapped up. The Raging Cajuns needed this victory. Now they're gearing up for the three-game Sun Belt Series this weekend at Troy. And they needed to have some momentum going into that game. They needed this. This is the type of game that you can build momentum off of. Like, if they would have went out there and mowed down Tulane, say 8-1 or 12-2, yeah, they would feel good about themselves. They'd have a little bit of confidence. But it always means more and it always makes more of an impact when you're a collegiate athlete if you do it in dramatic fashion. With your back or the team's back up against the wall and you come through in the clutch in a dramatic spot and you win a game, it just, and not only it pumps up everyone else on that team when that ball sailed over the left field wall and likely hit one of those pine trees there behind the Teague, it also gives you even additional confidence because it makes you think, hey, when the game is tight, when it's crunch time, when people are counting us out, we still have the ability to rise up and win the game. And that's what those dramatic wins like this do. Because you're going to be on a high. This team's going to be on a high for a while from this. And Tony Robichaux and his staff, they're going to try to take that energy and take that confidence and roll that into this weekend series with Troy. A much-needed win for them in Sun Belt play. It'd be great if they could go out there and get a sweep. But even if they just win the series, winning the series, winning a weekend series is going to be key for this Raging Cajuns team. As sensational as it was last night to win that game and to do so in dramatic fashion, they need to take that momentum and then take it into the weekend and build up even more momentum for the following week. They need that weekend series. That is key for this team if the Raging Cajuns are going to turn the corner and make a run here in the Sun Belt Conference.
And just to piggyback off of what you're talking about, momentum and how important a walk-off win can be as opposed to something. Because I know when you say they come out and they could have won that game 8-1, and that does good and that does things. But getting a walk-off victory like that, it just gives your team this extra excitement. Take this, for example, just a week ago when LSU played Nicholls in the midweek on Wednesday. LSU beat Nicholls 5-4 in 10 innings with a walk-off hit. And I want to say it was Josh Smith that got the walk-off hit. I could be mistaken. But the guy that got the walk-off, I mean, they tackled him. They bum-rushed the field. They ripped his jersey. I mean, they... for a midweek win over Nicholls.
Correct.
And this is LSU baseball we're talking about. So that's how excited and what kind of thing that a walk-off victory can do for a team. A team like LSU who should win that game, go shake hands and hit the locker room. No, they damn near dogpile Omaha style for a walk-off win over Nicholls in the midweek.
That's why I've never been one that fully believes that the midweek game is meaningless. You will have folks that will sit there and preach to you, the midweek game doesn't mean anything. The coaching staff doesn't care about it. Look how they approach it. That may be true. That may be true. The skippers may be like, it's not a big deal. Whatever.
A midweek game.
But to the players, I don't care. You see that reaction. You saw how the Raging Cajuns reacted last night to beating Tulane in a midweek game. You just pointed out what LSU did. These kids care. They care about these games. They care about every game they play. I don't give a damn how good they are, how heralded they are, if they're an All-American, if they're a draft pick, or if they're just a guy that is on the bench that's helping the APR. I do not care. These kids care about those midweek games. Right. They do. They always have. The coaches may not. The media may not. Fans may not give a damn. The kids, they do care, Cody.
A midweek game, to me, it does mean less, but it's not meaningless. Oh, if you're picking up what I'm putting down.
I love that. I am picking up what you're putting down. That is, yes.
I had to think really hard not to screw that up. When it popped into my head, I was like, oh, this is a good one. Say it right. Don't screw it up.
I would have screwed that
up. But it means less, but it is not meaningless.
Oh, bravo.
Yeah.
Bravo.
Put that on a t-shirt.
But
no regrets.
But a good game for the Raging Cajuns. Todd Lott had himself a game. He went 2 for 5 with 2 ribbies. Nathan Camp went 2 for 3. We already talked about Hayden. He was 1 for 2. He scored 3 runs. And then Handsome Monica. Name Hall of Fame? That's a name Hall of Fame, right?
You've heard the story behind the name, though.
Yes.
That is his legal name.
Yes.
They changed it when he was like 16 or something like that. His parents brought him to the courthouse.
Yes.
And because, you know, his mom growing up called him Handsome because he's a little boy. And his mom, no, Handsome, you're so cute. And I guess your friends, when your elementary school, middle school friends get a hold of that information, they begin to call you that. And next thing you know, you're at the courthouse changing your name legally to Handsome.
Yes, Handsome.
It's badass.
It is kind of badass. To be able to pull that off,
right,
like, yeah,
right.
What's up?
You have to go play or be athletic or an actor or some sort of, a thespian of some kind. Actor. And it'd just be great. But Handsome, name Hall of Fame, I'm going to say, yeah, maybe not like top tier, maybe not like a first ballot entry, but he's getting in. He's getting in.
Is it on the same level as, say, a Freddie Kitchens? Because that's first ballot Hall of Fame name.
Freddie Kitchens is It's not, I mean, you know.
It's the look, though, too, that Freddie brings to the table.
It is, and this is unfair because you get to make up your own name, but, like, I mean, wrestling has just, that is where the name Hall of Fame. I mean, King Kong Bundy, Hulk Hogan, Macho Man Randy Savage, and the like. That's where the name Hall of Fame is.
I want to see more modern athletes take on wrestling monikers.
Here we go.
How great would that be?
Usain Bolt.
Oh, that is.
That's first ballot unanimous decision into the Hall of Fame.
When I first heard, when he first came onto the scene, I thought, oh, that's just a made up name.
I thought so too.
That was a made up name.
Like, oh, what a stage name. What a track name.
No, that's legit. I was like, all right.
Your boy's name is Usain Bolt.
Let's hope that the Raging Cajuns can bolt out of the gate this weekend.
Gotta go to break on that.
Against Troy. And big up to Michael Lamont. He got the win, his first win of the season. He's now 1-3 overall. But the Raging Cajuns got a much-needed win, dramatic fashion. Hopefully they can build that momentum up into a weekend series victory on the road against the men of Troy. When we come back, we'll be diving into the greatest plays in Saints history. Why are we talking about that in March? I'll tell you why right here on the Rap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game.
Manning in the shotgun puts Colley in motion. Looks in his direction. It's picked off. It's Tracy Porter again. He's running free. He's going to go all the way. Hand outstretched. It is a safe touchdown. 70 yards on the return. 70 yards on the return by Porter. He did it to Favre, and now he's done it to Manning.
Tracy Porter's pick six in the Super Bowl there in Miami.
The pride and joy of Port Allen High School. Port Allen's favorite son, Tracy Porter.
That's right. Port Allen's favorite son, Tracy Porter.
And that's not hyperbole. He is Port Allen's favorite son. That's not.
First of all, he has Port in his name. How could he not be their favorite son?
And you know the Port Allen High School mascot, the Pelicans.
Oh, the Pelicans. Why are we bringing up Tracy Porter's pick six in
the Super Bowl? Not that I need a reason to, but why?
Well, the NFL is turning 100 years old. So each NFL team, based on fan votes, will submit their 4 best plays in team history. There will eventually be a bracket to determine the best play in NFL history. So, Saints fans, members of the Black and Gold, the Hoodats, you get to submit your 4 best plays in team history. So, Cody, will start things off. I'm going to assume that, now this is plays, it's not games. So this is plays. So that made me disappointed because I was like, well, damn, that means I cannot submit Todd Bowman's 5-turnover performance in Tiger Stadium during Hurricane Katrina year in a loss to the Carolina Panthers. Will not be making it. So I'll ask you.
Yes.
There's a lot to choose from. There's Dempsey's kick, right? Mm-hmm. There's Tracy Porter's pick six.
Uh-huh.
There's Drew Brees breaking so many different records.
Uh-huh.
There is, wait, we can't use, can we use an Aaron Brooks backwards pass?
That's for the four worst plays in Saints history. That'll go along with
Aaron Brooks backwards pass.
John Carney missed extra point. Like, we can do this too if you want.
Jason David getting burned after signing a free agent deal.
And Kyle Turley throwing someone else's helmet 50 yards down the field.
Oh, I love that.
That was the best.
That is the best.
He was so mad.
That is the best. I don't know what you're talking about. That
should go on this list.
That is.
But are you asking me what my top four plays are?
I hate to put you on the spot like that.
I think I can do it.
You think you can do it?
Of course, I just played you what is probably my favorite. Tracy Porter.
Okay, I'm writing these down. Okay.
Yeah, fair enough. Tracy Porter, pick six of Manning.
Porter, pick six.
Then I've got the rebirth game, Steve Gleason and the blocked punt.
Oh, that play. Yes.
That play is also very right up there. Maybe hear me out here. When Drew Brees breaks the record for all-time passing yards leader, it happens on a touchdown. So I'm losing my mind, right?
Yes.
They stop the game. He goes to the sideline and hugs his boys, and you get a live shot of Drew Brees telling his sons, you can do anything you want if you put your mind to it and work hard for your goals. So if I'm allowed to also bring in the aftermath of that play, the whole ambiance of it, then I am going to go with Drew Brees' touchdown pass to become the all-time leading passing yards leader in the NFL. And then for the final play, that's a tough one. But I don't know. See, I like the I forget the name of it, but the play before John Carney missed the field goal that put the Saints in the playoffs. Then they didn't. They ended up not making it because he missed the extra point. That play has a name. I forget what it's called. But
here's some other options for you. Okay, we mentioned the Tracy Porter pick six. All yours are terrific, Cody. You're talking about Tre'Quan Smith last year, the touchdown, the long touchdown reception, the record breaker.
Yeah.
Team Gleason, obviously the punt block in the 2006 reopening of the Superdome against Michael Vick and the Falcons.
It was on my
Tom Dempsey's 63-yard field goal to beat Detroit in November of 1970. Our boy, Barry Hurstis, and we'll bring this up with him on Friday, but he went ahead and he got very active about this yesterday. As you expect Barry Hurstis to do,
right.
the man that works for the Saints News Network.
He tells you himself he's an old man. He's been covering the Saints for a long time.
Yes.
I love you, Barry.
He also brings up the fourth quarter goal line stand at Pittsburgh in November of 87.
Oh, that one. Who could forget?
Which clinched the first ever winning season after 20 years of existence.
You know what a play I almost went with, but I couldn't remember enough specifics about it. To call it out, I believe it was against the Rams. Jim Haslett was the head coach. It was that era. It was the Saints' first playoff victory where they recovered a muffed punt. Mm-hmm. I forget who it was against, but that muffed punt was the difference in the game. And I think it was like one of the Schoble brothers, maybe. Did they play for the Saints at one point? He recovered that punt. So that's another thought for me.
Here's one that is a great play, but also ended poorly. And I'm talking about the multilateral against the Jags.
That's what happened to the play in Jacksonville where Carney then went and missed the damn extra point. That play has a name. I can't remember what it's called, but it has a...
I just always remember it as the Saints multilateral game.
It's the botch.
And you're like, oh, look at this.
We made the playoffs. John Carney's missed one extra point in his career. One extra point in his career. He was a kicker that wore number three. And he just, blew it all over.
Is there a play in the win against the Vikings in the NFC Championship?
Tracy Porter's pick six.
He had the pick six in that game too, right?
Tracy Porter's
pick six. It's going to be Porter pick six.
Yeah, then we'll go back. Who lit up? Who was it that lit up Kurt Warner? And just absolutely destroy, ended his career. Like, hey, and Favre, and man, like, y'all just go sit down. I forget who it was, but some guy for the side, I mean, just absolutely killed Kurt Warner. And that he can have a little love for himself, too. Shout out to that guy.
Yeah, and then you go, you know, Hartley makes that kick.
Yeah, that's
right?
A big kick.
That was a huge kick. Hartley's kick in the NFC title game, that's one. There's so many good ones. You know, Breeze, that Jimmy Graham touchdown against the 49ers with like 11 seconds left. That was a hell of a game, even though we called him soft, and I stay, I'm not taking that back.
Sorry, following your Vernon Davis cried like a little, you know what?
Oh, there it is. Here's one. The onside kick.
Ambush.
Yeah. Ambush in the Super Bowl. That changed the whole narrative of that game.
It did. That's man. Just in the Super Bowl, we could sit here and debate for an hour whether the pick six or the onside kick after halftime was more pivotal.
So we're going to throw it up. We're going to give you a third Twitter poll question, but it's going to take us a little while because Cody and I have to decide what the options are going to be.
We got this, though.
Because there's so many good ones. We'll throw that up there. Let you vote on yours so you can go ahead and get that in your brain. That way you can vote officially for your favorite moment in Saints history. When we come back, we're going to talk to the voice of the LSU Tigers, the one and only Chris Blair, right here on the Rap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the Rap Game with RP3. I am your host, Raymond Parsa III, here on 103.7 The Game, your home for the LSU Tigers. Just a reminder, you can listen to the first game of LSU's road series at Mississippi State when they're going to be taking on those Fighting Cowbells. Pregame show, 5:30, first pitch a little after 6 o'clock. Also a reminder, you can listen to LSU men's basketball Sweet 16 matchup versus Tom Izzo in mighty Michigan State Friday night right here on 103.7 The Game. 5:30 pregame show, 6 o'clock tip. And now we're going to head out to the Arco Equipment Hotline and welcome on the man who will be on the call Friday night in the nation's capital. He is the voice of the LSU Tigers, the one and only Chris Blair. Chris, how are you this morning, brother?
I'm doing good, Raymond. Good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for making some time for us, man. I know it's a busy time of the year for you, and that's a good thing because if you're swamped with assignments right now, that means things are going well with the Tigers. So let's start off with baseball, brother. Your thoughts from last night's game, 2-0 loss at McNeese State. They had the players-only meeting out on the field afterwards. I like that. I like the fact that the leaders on the team take that initiative and say, hey, enough is enough. Let's get this right. Let's get this together. What were your thoughts on the game, in particular how the Tigers struggled at the plate, and what did you think of the players-only meeting afterwards?
Yeah, it's a little concerning. I mean, now you've lost three in a row. It's a short week. You got to turn around and head to Starkville and take on the number two team in the country who just put up 35 runs in their last two games in conference against Auburn. So you kind of were hoping that even though you came away from Athens and won just one game, I mean, that's a very good Georgia team. And it was a pretty intimidating atmosphere at Foley Field. They're right down there on top of you. It was some of their first sellouts in a long time this past weekend. So you had some positives to take away from the trip to Athens, and you hoped that, you know, that would kind of kickstart them going into not only the game with McNeese last night, but also building as they went to Starkville. And frankly, it was just uninspiring. I mean, it just didn't look like from the very get-go that LSU was not necessarily wasn't locked in. There just wasn't a lot of energy. There wasn't a lot of excitement. Dugout was kind of quiet. And then obviously they struggled at the plate, just four hits. We were told going into the game, Mikhail Hilliard would probably throw two innings, maybe a little bit more. He got off to a good start, you know, with just 18 pitches through the first two innings. Ran into trouble there after an error. Got, you know, the Cowboys a man aboard to start the bottom or top of the third. But from LSU offensively, just not much doing. You know, they had some mistakes, base running. You know, they had opportunities. I think they left 5-6 men on base, but they had scoring opportunities even late. Just unable to do it. So I like the team meeting. I agree with you. They typically meet after every game in right field for 3 to 5 minutes. Usually coaches, you know, giving them instructions, talking about the game and then what they need to do next. But, they were literally out there, for nearly 25, almost half an hour with the players. Coaches were out there as well, but the players were doing all the talking. And, you know, we could see in their face and by their body language, it was not a very, how should I say, quiet talk. There was a lot of emotion. The problem was there wasn't enough emotion during the game, but maybe that's what they needed following the game to get them ready to go, because they got to be ready to go when they get to Starkville tomorrow.
We're talking to the voice of the LSU Tigers, the one and only Chris Blair. Chris, let's talk a little bit about that matchup. The Bulldogs are ranked as the number two team in the country by the majority of the polls. That's always a tough environment to play in. It's the second straight weekend of a road series for the Tigers. Even though they're coming off the loss and it's a short turnaround, as you pointed out, because they'll begin play Thursday, what kind of effort, what kind of energy do you expect to see out of LSU now heading into that series, especially with the lengthy players-only meeting last night following the loss?
Well, again, as I said, I was a little, you know, kind of taken aback of the uninspired play last night. But I don't expect that, you know, when Mississippi State and LSU get together. I mean, you can go back to the Ron Polk, Skip Bertman days, go back and check those scores and check those game stories. You'll see that regardless of who the better team was on paper or who had the better lineup or better pitching staff in a given series, it's always been a battle. And Coach Paul Maneri, you know, to his credit, I mean, he's dominated this matchup with Mississippi State when you look at series by series over the years. So, I don't have any doubt that they'll be ready to go. You know, the problem's going to be, again, they're short on arms. I mean, they may only have maybe five true relievers that can go for them through this three-game set. So just like in the Kentucky series and much like what they needed in Athens, I mean, they're going to have their starting pitchers go deep. You know, the good news was Zach Hess was able to do so last week against Georgia. Again, it's going to be a little shorter rest period for him. But he's an alpha competitor, so I don't think he'll have any trouble. But you got to get him deep. Cole Henry, I thought, pitched well for you in game two last week. And I can see him improving game by game and outing by outing. So he's going to have to go deep for you. And I guess the only other good news coming out of Athens in game three, the fact that Eric Walker was extended to five innings. That's his longest outing on the year after missing all of last year. So, but they're going to need those guys to go deep. They got to eat some innings. Especially game one and game two, and hope that they have arms ready to go in game three. Should it be a rubber match, or should the Tigers, you know, try to get one win? So, but I don't think there's going to be any problem with the team being fired up, and I think the team meeting last night would help that. But frankly, I've seen, you know, four of these series now: Mississippi State and LSU, and you're talking about some of the best college baseball players for both teams in the country. They're going to be ready to compete.
We're on with Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Tigers. Chris, when your broadcasting partner, Doug Thompson, starts riffing on Starkville as he did last night when he said Starkville is the Indian name for trailer park trash or whatever it was, how do you keep a straight face? How do you not just bust out into laughter, brother, right there on the air?
Well, it's hard sometimes because I kind of knew that's where Doug was going to go. All the guys who play for Skip Bertman, they have all of the Starkville jokes memorized. So I kind of stepped into it. I was trying to get him to talk about his career, which I ended up doing that. But I should have known better. But he actually messed it up. It's just trailer park. He said trailer trash. And frankly, I don't want to say that about the fine folks of Starkville. So he needs to work on his punchline.
And then the other one on the broadcast last night that I was listening to was, he says, yeah, I've already booked my room. I made sure to get a room without a view. And I was like, because you kept trying to tell him, oh, you know, you haven't been there since 97. They've done all these great improvements there. And Starkville, in reality, is growing, right? There's a lot more there than there used to be. Okay, when it was, you know, you kind of mock them, call them Stark Vegas. They're actually growing as a community. But You handled that like a pro, brother, so good job. I don't know if I would be able to.
Well, thank you, but I was trying to let him know. I mean, it has been a while since he's been there, but those Skip guys, they don't like Starkville. So I tried to tell him about some of the new eateries that are there, and he was having none of it.
He was having none of it. Chris, let's leave the diamond and let's go to the hardwood. The first two games of the NCAA tournament ended up being a little bit dramatic, or more, maybe more dramatic than LSU fans wanted. But the Tigers stepped up and got the win over Yale, despite the second half lull, and then they got the win in dramatic fashion against Maryland. I want your take on Skylar Mays. A lot's been made about Naz Reid, the sensational freshman, Javonte Smart, obviously Tremont Waters, all SEC, but man. It seems like when they need a big play and they need someone to provide leadership on the court and probably off of it, it's Skylar Mays. I've been so impressed with him. What are your thoughts about what he brings to this team?
He's one of my favorite players I've ever been around, you know, at any school, any level. He's just the epitome of a student athlete, and he's just a calming force on this team. And, you know, he's been through the battles. He's had some highs. He's had some lows. He just keeps an even keel and, you know, doesn't get real emotional. Occasionally he does, but most of the time he's pretty steady. And I think that's what's beneficial for a team that, if you just look at their play for most of the season, it's been, you know, very, very good, and then there's moments of very, very bad. So, again, I think that's why he's so important to this team, is that he kind of stays right there in the middle and does an excellent job of calming his teammates down. And, you know, and I think all of them have gained quite a bit of confidence in the close games and the overtime games that they played this year. And I know all of us as Tiger fans wish you could go in and just dominate a team and, you know, run away with it down the final 6 minutes. But the two things to that. Number one, that's not really been LSU's MO all season long. I mean, we joked with the team as we were getting on the bus to leave Jacksonville on Saturday, saying, you know, I don't know why we were nervous. I mean, we've seen this 1,000 times. This is what you guys do. Never doubt. But also, it's the NCAA tournament. And, I mean, these are the best of the best. And now you enter the Sweet 16. You know, there's been a lot of talk about should they reseed once you go into the Sweet 16. Well, I guess if that's going to make coaches and players and fan bases feel better about themselves. But the fact of the matter is the teams that are there for a reason, and I don't think seeding really matters. But you saw a Tennessee team who had a 25-point lead had to fight the overtime to get to the Sweet 16. So, you know, again, it's nice to be able to pull away and win a game by big double-digit margins. But that's just hard to do in the NCAA tournament, especially this deep. And now they get ready to take on a team and a coach that is built for the NCAA tournament, built for the Sweet 16, the Great Eight, and the Final Four in Michigan State. I mean, this is what they do each and every year. So it'll be a tall task. It's hopefully not one of those games where LSU comes out and plays extremely well and then gets slow in the second half, because you're going to need to be firing on all cylinders once you get to this level in this type of competition.
Chris, what's the biggest hurdle that LSU faces against Tom Izzo and Michigan State? What do they do so well that LSU is going to have to, you know, overcome?
Well, they're just good defensively. You know, a lot of people have asked, will we see zone from Michigan State? You know, Maryland went to the zone in the second half, the majority of the second half, and was kind of able to cut away at that 15-point lead that the Tigers had early in the second stanza. Michigan State doesn't have to play zone. They haven't played a lot of zone, I think. Based on the film, they've played maybe 30 possessions of zone defense this season. That's not very much. And so they've been able to defend well, keep people's field goal percentage down. They defensively rebound the ball extremely well. And they're just a sound, fundamental defensive team. Now, don't mistake the fact that they do have offensive firepower as well. I mean, they've got one of the best point guards in the country, you know, scoring, I think, somewhere just under 19 points a game. He leads the Big Ten in assists. He was a Big Ten Player of the Year. So the matchup in the point guard area is going to be interesting to watch. But, you know, as I said, Michigan State, I mean, the one thing I think is key, LSU goes about 8 deep. One of the big successes for them this year has been when Emmett Williams and Darius Days get on the floor. There's been games when they really have contributed. Most of the time, they don't cause mistakes and they don't hurt your team, but it's kind of lanyap when they're able to go in and get you 8-10 points and 6-7 rebounds. And that's what Darius Days did on Saturday against Yale. We've seen Emmett Williams do it a number of times. Michigan State, based on a tough injury to one of their top players that will go. I mean, they only go really about seven deep when it comes to minutes and points. So, again, if LSU can attack, get to the rim, maybe get to the foul line, put them in foul trouble, they're not a very deep team. But, boy, their front five and their front six for Michigan State are, as I said, built for this type of tournament.
We're talking to Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Tigers. Chris, we'll wrap it up with this, brother. Tony Benford takes over. It's not the most ideal situation with the national media putting the spotlight on the program for all the wrong reasons. He's done, I feel, a very good job of handling everything with being thrust into that role the day before the regular season finale versus Vanderbilt, then at the SEC tournament, and now through the NCAA tournament. How impressed have you been with the job that Tony has done as the interim head coach for this team?
Well, he's done a phenomenal job, and he's just a super nice guy. And, you know, I think the best decision that Tony made was, you know, after being named the interim head coach, he simply went to Greg Heyer and Bill Armstrong and said, guys, we were the three assistants under Will Wade. We've got to kind of co-coach this team now. We know the right buttons to push. We know how to handle each guy individually as the game goes along and also in preparation. So there's no reason to go in and for Tony Benford to say, okay, now this is quote-unquote my team and we're going to do it this way or we're going to run this tempo or, you know, this is the type of defense. I mean, they frankly have done exactly down to when they eat pregame meal, when they go to shoot around, when they have rest time, when we travel. Everything has remained the same because obviously coaches like to keep teams, you know, with a habit and in a routine. But that's the best thing. I mean, those guys are constantly three basketball minds during the game, you know, consulting each other on what needs to be done at a particular time, who needs to be on the floor, who needs to be subbed out. And I think that's really the biggest thing I can say about Coach Benford is he knows he's got a good team. He knows he's got a hungry team. He knows he has a team that, you know, has been able to for the most part, keep out all the noise. When everybody in college basketball says they shouldn't be there, they don't deserve to be there, they can't give LSU credit for anything they've done, and frankly haven't done it all season, to be honest with you. So he understands that. So instead of trying to come in and make these even subtle changes, you just keep doing what you do, and I think he's done a good job of not being tempted to try to make major changes, not only before a game, but certainly during game. So I give credit to all three of the guys. It's a tough spot to be in, as you said. The team, frankly, I think is used to this. As I said, they're the Rodney Dangerfield of college basketball and have been all season. Nobody's given them respect. Nobody thought they could win the SEC. Even when they won the SEC, nobody really talked about that. So it's, you hear the cliche, us against the world a lot of times, but I can tell you firsthand because I travel and stay and eat with this team, that's the way they feel, and that's the way they're going to feel headed to the nation's capital later this afternoon.
Chris, appreciate you making some time for us, brother. Enjoy being on the call there in D.C. on Friday, and we'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Thank you very much for having me. Again, welcome to all the Tiger fans. Hopefully they'll tune in on Friday night. The Tigers can keep on winning.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate you, man. That's Chris Blair, voice of the LSU Tigers. He'll be on the call Friday night. You can listen, once again, reminder, you can listen to LSU's Sweet 16 game versus Michigan State. Pregame show 5:30 on Friday. Tip at 6 o'clock. You can listen to it right here on 103.7 The Game. We will wrap up the second hour of today's show after this break.
Are you looking forward to the nighttime spring game?
This Rip Ross is playing supposedly after. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, good, because we're kind of wet, kind of sweating, brother. Not to say that it's actually going to be there, but so then he go or something like that. I can't wait. So,
how can you not just adore that man? I am sorry. I know that he got stale as the LSU head coach, but he is an absolute treasure, and I miss him every day. I miss Les Miles being the head coach of the LSU Tigers. That is Les Miles yesterday during spring practice. He's in his first year as the Kansas University head football coach and the soon-to-be enshrined into the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame this summer. He announces that Rick Ross, that's right, Maybach Music himself, he will be performing. Kansas is having their spring game at night, and then they're having like a big celebration afterwards, like a concert and the whole make it a whole day event to get people riled up about the football team, which has been woefully just woeful, terrible.
Charlie Weiss just crushed, destroyed that program.
Ran that program into the ground. And he announces that he's got Rick Ross going to be performing. I love how he turns to the assistant there and he's like,
"Is that true?
Is that true? Yeah, Rick Ross is playing supposedly after first of all, Les Miles has no idea who the hell Rick Ross is.
Doesn't he go hoo 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 or something?
I think he tried to do the little Rick Ross. I can't wait," he said. It's called Late Night Under the Lights is how they're framing the event for their spring game.
Hustling in Topeka.
Yes, this is so God bless him.
That is the best. I mean,
just.
I hope he rolls up in like a purple Lamborghini, like blasting hustling from like at the top, just blowing speakers out. I mean,
plays Box Chevy, plays
This is
The Devil Is a Lie, and just goes through the whole thing and just have Miles there off stage, just enjoying himself. Just sitting there, Lester just bobbing his head.
But no, real quick, we talked about it. Les Miles, maybe head coach tactics, meh, master recruiter. This is one hell of a recruiting tactic.
You damn right. You think getting Rosé to go?
Ricky Rosé.
To go to Lawrence, Kansas? You don't think that's going to have weight on the recruiting trail? Les Miles may do dummy things, but he ain't a dummy.
No.
Okay. He knows what he's doing there. I love it. Les Miles is getting Rick Ross before at the spring game. Dr. Pepper commercial and now Rick Ross at the spring game. No one is winning the college football offseason more than our boy, Les Miles.
Live and local from the 237 Roof Studios in Upper Lafayette. We are Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time to step your game up.
Boy, you wouldn't know how to write your name if it wasn't set for lunch locker.
It's Rep Game with RP3, Raymond Parts the Third.
One of God's own prototypes. A high-powered mutant of some kind never even considered for mass production. Too weird to live, too rare to die.
Want to interact? Call in at 337-706-0111.
We have it.
RP3 is taking the mic and bringing you to the center of the sports world on Rep Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game and 1037thegame.com.
He's got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
Solid. I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
Welcome to the third hour of the Rep Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parsa III, here on 103.7 The Game, home of the LSU Tigers, broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're going to head out now to the ARCO Equipment Hotline and welcome on our second guest of the day. He covers the LSU men's basketball team, baseball team, football team, table tennis team. If it's LSU related, my man is covering it. It's the one and only Ron Higgins. Ron, how are you this morning, brother?
I'm good, man. I'm packing to head north.
Yeah, that's going to be a long trip. Are you driving or flying, brother?
I'm flying. I'm driving this bus thing. It's too far.
I hear you. Well, Ron, let's get right to it, man. Let's talk, before we get to the basketball talk, let's talk a little baseball. What do you make of LSU's woes at the plate? They're only batting .274 as a team on the season. They only got three guys batting over .300. Duplantis is now under .300 for the year. And they dropped the game last night 2-0 to McNeese State. What do you make of the struggles at the plate for the Tigers this year?
I think right now they're probably pressing the plate too much. I think they're letting the outside noise get to them instead of just kind of trying to block it out and go out and just kind of, you know, relax at the plate and get your swings in. I think they're just pressing too much. And honestly, I think it, it it's all connected to the pitching also, because they don't know what they're going to get from game to game with their pitching. They just really don't. They have no idea. And I think because of that, I think it's all kind of interconnected. And that when they, you know, they finally got good, pretty good pitching over the weekend for the most part. You know, and then they had a really dry spell, really first two games, an unfortunate win. They kind of broke out the last game, but they didn't get the pitch in the last game. So I think there's an effort by everybody to kind of press them to help each other, and then it's kind of being kind of productive at the moment.
Ron, what do you make of the players-only meeting that lasted extremely long, where the vets kind of did some butt-chewing there after last night's game? You think that's a positive?
Oh, yeah, I think it's always a positive when you have a players-only meeting. I mean, this kind of it kind of gets people, let's say, refocused, but, you know, you need your players to step up and be your leaders, especially your veterans, when they feel like something is not quite right. And it's really, a coach can only say so much, but after that, it's really up to veterans to kind of take hold of what's going on, and really to express what needs to be done. But it's not like they usually have these meetings almost every year at LSU in baseball at some time of the year. And basketball has had them occasionally this year. With the players, and so it's. I never think player-only meetings can hurt. It always can help. It kind of clears the air.
Ron, tell me a little bit about. I know this Mississippi State and LSU. It's salty between the two programs, and you've covered it in the past. I know Skip Bertman and all of his guys always had a plethora of jokes about Starkville and about the Bulldogs in general. Why do you think this series between these two teams has been so kind of salty, specifically just for the baseball teams?
Because they're the two teams that basically, they're the two programs that brought the SEC baseball out of the dark ages. And they're the ones that are responsible for doing it. I mean, first, Mississippi State with Ron Polk as coach showed that baseball could make money in the SEC. If you do it the right way, promote it the right way, and recruit the right kids with the right program, and have a pretty good facility, people will come. And shortly thereafter, Skip Bertman showed up and kind of took it to a new level. And so they're the two teams in this league who showed the way for everybody else. Everybody else followed. And the reason the SEC baseball is so good today is because of Mississippi State and LSU. You know, they built facilities when nobody else would. They hired decent coaches when nobody else would. And so, you know, there's a rivalry there because they believe they are the two, you know, schools responsible for building baseball, and they are. And that's why there's a rivalry there. And that's why every time these teams get together, it's special because of the history of that.
Yeah, you're talking about how they helped them get out of the dark ages. Obviously, Mississippi State, they had Thunder and Lightning, Will Clark and Rafael Palmeiro, and that kind of put Mississippi State on the map, helped put SEC baseball on the map around the same time that LSU was doing the same thing. Let's go to the hardwood, Ron. That's where you're going to be traveling to. You're going to be going up to the nation's capital to see if LSU can extend its postseason run. What are your thoughts on the performances of the Tigers from the first two rounds when they defeat Yale and Maryland? They had the lulls in the second half, but you and I have talked about that. This is what this team is. This is what this team does. What impressed you the most from those two games, and what were two things that you were slightly maybe concerned about?
Well, I mean, of course, I'm always impressed at how cool LSU stays when things are going south and they finally figure out how to pull out a tailspin. I thought they played really, I mean, great defense on Yale, really, until, you know, the final 3 or 4 minutes when Yale hit four threes in about a minute, which was about half of their three total for the game. And they played, golly, a pretty solid 25 minutes against Maryland until the 15 minute or 16 minute mark, say 24 minutes when Maryland coach got a technical, had a timeout and switched to a zone that LSU just couldn't figure out for the longest time. But LSU's perseverance and their senior leader, I mean, their leadership of their juniors, and then, I mean, a Skylar, and then Tremon is a sophomore, how they kind of coach and play through stuff. But the lulls concern me because I don't think you can have a lull like that against Michigan State and probably expect to come back. I mean, you're looking at a coach who is coaching in this 22nd NCAA tournament, I believe. Been to numerous Sweet 16s and regional finals and Final Fours, won a national championship. And I just think this weekend LSU can't afford to have a lull like that against Maryland where they were like, God, I mean, they were like one for 16 from the field or something like that in the stretch and like 0-for-12 from 3-point range. Just a bad stretch of basketball. They really can't afford to have that this week. I think Michigan State's too well coached. I don't think physically they're overwhelming Michigan State, but they always are mentally and physically tough. And they rebound well, and they have the Big Ten Player of the Year and point guard Cassius Winston, who really makes everything happen for them. Really good basketball player.
Michigan, we're on with Ron Higgins, LSU beat writer for Tiger Details. Ron, defensively, Michigan State is extremely stout. They do not play a lot of zone. We know that. So what are going to be some of the challenges, or what are some of the keys to the game for LSU offensively? Are there any weak areas with Michigan State? This is the regular season Big Ten champion and tournament champion, and we talked about how much of a veteran Tom Izzo is with the national championship under his belt. He knows how to coach. Are there any weaknesses, though, that Sparty has that LSU can exploit?
Well, I mean, LSU needs to get the ball inside. I mean, and they need to score in the paint like they always do. But I mean, LSU physically has an advantage inside, and they need to go with their offense inside out. They need to go into Naz and Big B Williams and work inside out. But also, they've got to keep those guys out of foul trouble. They did the other day, against Maryland, did all first half. They kept them out of foul trouble. But that quickly, went by the wayside early in the second half. But for me, LSU is always usually the first key to keeping the big guys out of foul trouble because they don't have anybody off the bench who can really replicate that toughness, even though they've got a little bit of that lately. But that inside toughness and length, they don't have that come off the bench. They have the toughness, but not the length. And they got to afford to keep the big guys out of foul trouble. That would help LSU greatly because I think Michigan State understands the LSU strengths and weaknesses. And I'll be interested to see. Izzo doesn't like most veteran coaches is very stubborn about playing zone defense. But Mark Targett of Maryland was the same way until that 16-minute mark. He was down by 15. He just got a technical and he went to a zone because he finally realized he had nobody who could stay in front of Tremont Waters, and it worked beautifully. So I'm wondering what happens with Michigan State if LSU does the same thing. It's penetration over and over again. Will Tom Izzo be stubborn and stick with a man, or will he go with the zone? Because LSU does struggle against zones. So that'll be fascinating for me to see if he goes ahead and makes that switch or sticks with his man-to-man and believes it will get better if LSU is having success against it.
We're talking to Ron Higgins, LSU beat writer. Ron, obviously, LSU is going to be the underdog, but I find something interesting here. A lot of the national conversation this week has been about all the teams not in the SEC, and not only not an LSU thing, a perspective. I've seen national people talk about the teams, hey, this is the Sweet 16, Elite Eight, who's going to reach the Final Four? Not only are they not talking about LSU, but no one's really talking about Tennessee, and no one's talking about Kentucky. How does the SEC have three teams in the Sweet 16, and yet they're kind of under the radar? How does that happen?
Well, I guess because, you know, there's a question with Kentucky about P.J. Washington, whether he'll play or not. I think he will. How effective he'll be, I don't know, but I'm sure that's the question there. With Tennessee, they're a veteran group, but I know that people are looking at the fact they blew a 25-point lead against Iowa and almost lost. I guess they're looking at that and thinking, wondering if these, you know, now it gets to another round where it's a little bit tighter and the pressure's more, if they were actually going to hold up. So, I mean, I kind of understand their viewpoint on that because of what happened last weekend. And, of course, everybody thinks LSU's lucky as hell, I mean, every week, because they just keep winning that way. And you know, if you haven't watched that team all year, that's just LSU's M.O. That's just the way they are. I mean, that, and as soon as that Maryland game ended, my thought was, well, this is pretty much a typical LSU game this year. You know,
right.
Just come out, play great, disappear, and come back and make incredible plays at the end to win. I kind of understand the national mindset on that.
But every team has shown that they're vulnerable. I mean, Duke, if UCF has a putback, Duke is eliminated, and they're the number one overall seed, and everyone says they're going to win the national championship. So not only did Tennessee and Kentucky have struggles, and LSU, you know, has those lulls, Duke almost got beat. Michigan State had moments of struggling, and a lot of the other teams in the Sweet 16, including Virginia, all those teams easily could have lost in the first weekend as well. So that's why I just find it curious that, you know, none of that's kind of brought, you know, is not really kind of a talking point, Ron.
Well, except for Kentucky, all those schools in the SEC aren't basketball schools, allegedly. And all the schools you talked about are basketball schools who've had tradition. And so, naturally, national media sides with tradition. I mean, I felt terrible for UCF. I mean, they missed the lob that would have put them up by six. And then Duke hit the three, and then, you know, they couldn't finish. I mean, you know, Zion pushed off on his drive. They didn't call it. You know, the gap, UCF probably got shoved on his drive on the last drop of the basket, but they didn't call that. I felt terrible for them. They couldn't finish it. You know, there's this, I mean, to me, the best team I watched in terms so far is North Carolina. I think North Carolina is better than Duke. And I just think they have, I just think Carolina is a steadier group of players. I had to pick somebody right now. I pick Carolina, not Duke. I think Carolina is better than Duke, even though they lost last time they played against Duke, but not by much. I just think Carolina is a better team than Duke, and so we'll see what happens.
Ron, appreciate you making some time for us, as always. Be safe out there traveling, man, and enjoy your time in the nation's capital, and we'll talk to you soon, my friend.
All right, take care. We'll see you.
It's Ron Higgins, TigerDetails.com. Breaking down some LSU baseball and some LSU men's basketball for us. When we come back, we'll keep it on the hardwood as we talk some New Orleans Pelicans right here on the Rap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game. In Louisiana, there are thousands of miles of utility lines and gas pipelines buried just beneath the surface. Sometimes multiple lines are in one area. So if you or a contractor that you have hired is digging a hole to put in a new fence, a pool, or for another reason, you run the risk of hitting an underground line even by digging only a few inches. What happens then? Maybe you only knock the power out for your entire neighborhood, but sometimes there's an explosion with injuries and even death. It happens every year, and there's a very simple way to avoid it. Before you dig, call 811. Call 811 2 days before you dig. Tell the operator your address, and someone will come out and mark the location of buried lines so you or your contractor can avoid them. Simple, right? It's free of charge, and it's the law. Louisiana One Call operates 811 as a public service, and to promote public safety, Louisiana One Call and 103.7 The Game remind you, call 811 and know what's below before you dig.
49-44. Points off the takeaway. It'll be Christian Wood. Good lead. Alfred Payton on the dime. Back to a three-point game. Memphis is that way. I watched that game last night. Man, was that strange. Wood going to the line looking for the three-point play.
The New Orleans Pelicans. That's right. Pelicans talk there. They didn't get the victory last night versus the Atlanta Hawks. They lost 130-120. But, once again, it's another example of them showing a lot of fight and lesser-known guys, guys that are trying to earn a contract, guys that are trying to stay in the league, stick with a team, maybe even stick with the Pels, stepping up. Christian Wood was one of those guys. When he played in 17 games with the 76ers back in 2015-16, he recorded a total of 7 blocks. In 13 games with the Charlotte Bobcats / Hornets in 2016-17, he only had 6 blocks. In 13 games with the Milwaukee Bucks last season, 17-18, he had 0 blocks. He had 6 on Tuesday versus the Atlanta Hawks. And here's something that you have to keep in mind with the Pelicans is they're still losing, which means that they're increasing the probability of earning themselves a high draft pick, which they're going to be doing with a massive rebuild. They will trade Anthony Davis this summer. Okay. They'll get assets from him, players and picks, but they'll have their own draft pick that they'll be using to help rebuild and mold this team for the future. So that's a good thing. The other thing is that a lot of these guys are getting reps, much-needed reps, because, look, a problem for the Pels has been depth in the last few years. So maybe a lot of these guys that are showing their potential right now, they're not going to be starters. And they're not starters in the league. But they can give the Pels quality depth, and they're going to get a ton of minutes. Whether that's Elfrid Payton, whether or not he comes back, whether or not that's going to be Julius Randle if he decides to come back, or any of these guys. And the other thing that I like that I see from this team, and whether or not Alvin Gentry remains the coach, a lot of people debate that on whether or not they feel Gentry deserves to be a coach or if he's done a good job. And we'll dive more into that with our good buddy Les East, who will be joining us here at 8:32 from CrescentCitySports.com. Is they play hard for Alvin. And if you're working the front office, you have to be impressed with the fact that even with lesser players, even with guys that are essentially G League guys, he's getting maximum effort out of this team, right? Now, they're not executing and they're falling short and they're still losing games, but they're showing a lot of heart and they're showing a lot of effort. The execution is the part that is concerning. I mean, they had 24 turnovers last night. The Hawks scored 26 points off of those mistakes. That's your game right there. So they have things that they need to clean up. But once again, here's another guy, newly signed. Christian Wood is only 23 years old. He's on his fourth team in 4 seasons. He was waived by the Bucks a week ago. Now, the Bucks are going to the playoffs. They're the number one team in the Eastern Conference. They have a legit chance of making the NBA Finals. And he's on that roster, and all of a sudden he's cut, and the only team that can scoop him up is the Pels, one of the worst teams in the NBA. And he scored 7 points in 8 minutes in his debut with the Pels on Sunday. And then last night he finished career best in points with 23, rebounds 9, blocks 6, steals 3, free throws made 8, and free throws attempted 14 in minutes. It was a hell of a game for the young man. Frank Jackson, though, did suffer concussion. He'll be likely out. And also, it was announced last night that Drew Holiday has had to have surgery and that he will now be officially shut down for the remainder of the season. and he'll be ready for next year, though. So, once again, a defeat for the Pels, but is there a silver lining? Yeah. And you get a guy like this that just got cut a week ago who gets a chance to have a career night. So you got to root for the Pels just for that reason. We'll talk more about the Pels, what they're doing, and Julius Randle all of a sudden not being able to rebound the ball with our good friend Les East right here on the Rap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game.
We met for a long time, and then we're very, I would say, very respectful and opinion-driven, and yet not at all, I think, anything but, really. And I think that today, this set of owners' meetings, for me, and forget the specific rule, there were just a lot of great, healthy discussions about our game, and someone asked about, you know, our fans specifically in New Orleans, and I said, look, when you're on this committee, you know, there's a little bit of a responsibility, just, you know, the game and football fans in general. So, but I would say in a very positive way, Sal, that if someone was speaking with the mic in a very in a comfortable forum to speak, and the committee certainly was mindful of that, and yet then we went back and boom, 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 and work through it. So in this first year with expansion, let's just call it that, we're expanding replay. I think the feeling was, let's begin here. I think if any time.
That was Sean Payton live from Arizona yesterday talking about the fact that the NFL owners have agreed to a rule change allowing coaches to throw challenge flags when it comes to calls or non-calls. And particularly pass interference, you can essentially call it the Saints call or the Tommy Lee Lewis got trucked call, however you want to frame it.
It'd be the Crescent City challenge flag?
The Crescent
Something
City
like
challenge.
That. We'll work on it. We'll get there.
We'll make it Mardi Gras colors. It'd be specific just for that. But just for
that's
that.
Really good. That's a good one.
But that's been approved, and Sean Payton was talking about that. And that occurred yesterday, so that change will take effect for the 2019 season. We'll get reaction on that, as well as some New Orleans Pelicans talk from our next guest as we head out to the Arco Equipment Hotline here on the Rap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game. He covers the New Orleans Saints as well as the New Orleans Pelicans for CrescentCitySports.com. It's the one and only, our good friend Les East. Les, how are you this morning, my friend?
I'm doing well, Raymond. How are you?
I'm doing well as well. Your first reaction. Were you surprised that the owners, that Gail Benson and Sean Payton were able to work their magic and do it so quickly there in Arizona this week?
I'm always surprised when the NFL owners do the right thing. So, yeah. They obviously, this was something that needed to be improved. The fact that you could have a game of the magnitude of the NFC Championship decided essentially the way it was, with as egregious an infraction as a player could commit, not being able to be reviewed or challenged or corrected or properly enforced within the replay system and the challenge system. Obviously left a big hole in the system, and they addressed it. They made some changes, and, you know, if that were to happen the way it did back in January in the Superdome, if it were to happen in 2019, at least there would be an opportunity to get it right. So it's an improvement.
We're all talking with Les East of CrescentCitySports.com. That wasn't the only positive news coming out involving the Saints yesterday, Les. The deal is finally done with Jarrett Cook. Apparently, the New England Patriots tried to make a late push for him. He would not budge. He signs a two-year deal with the New Orleans Saints. What did you think about the deal finally being done, and where do you think the Saints go from here with the remainder of free agency, and in particularly in the draft?
Well, I think that's the most significant offseason move to date for the Saints, and probably will wind up being the same. I think we talked two or three weeks ago, but as free agency was getting underway, And I didn't really think the Saints had much of a chance of getting Jared Cook. He's the most attractive tight end on the open market and was going to command significant money. At that time, they had not restructured Drew Brees or Cam Meredith, so they were really limited, and it probably would have been very difficult for them to get him with the money they entered free agency with. But after the restructuring, they had some dollars to play with. It was a great get for them. I think that was their biggest offseason need, was to upgrade the tight end position. They got the best option out there, in my opinion, either in free agency or in the draft. I wondered a bit where it was going when it dragged on so long, because I met with him a couple of weeks ago, and then things just kind of sat there for a while. I thought he was probably waiting to see what Rob Gronkowski did, figuring that if he did retire, which he did Sunday night to virtually no one's surprise, that maybe the Patriots would jump in and grab him or at least drive the price up. But doesn't seem to have really affected him. So I'm not sure why it dragged on the way it did, but it's great for the Saints that they got the deal done. It's, like I said, the biggest move in free agency, one that didn't seem very likely just a few weeks ago. So that makes their offseason look a whole lot better than it did 24 hours ago. I think they're still going to try and plug in a couple of pieces, possibly another offensive lineman, possibly a DB. I think this makes tight end less of a priority going into the draft, especially with that second-round pick. But I still think there's a good chance they'll add another tight end somewhere along the way, whether it be a free agent or a lower pick in the draft.
Les, is wide receiver something that they need to address? Because here's my thought on that. You got Michael Thomas on the outside. You're going to have Alvin Kamara coming out of the backfield, and now you're going to have Jared Cook. Those are going to be your three top targets and your three top receiving leaders for this team, if healthy, for the 2019 season. Then you're going to have maybe Ted Ginn Jr. as your number four option. And that leaves three guys battling for the five and six spots. And Cam Meredith is all potential, but they got him to restructure his deal. Tre'Quan Smith showed some brief flashes, but he was just a rookie last year. And then Kirkwood probably had the best season of those three. Do you really need to go sign another wide receiver when you got those three guys all fairly young, can battle to be your number five and number six options?
Well, I think they need to add another receiver one way or another. I don't think they go out and spend a lot of money on a big-name free agent, but I do think they don't want to be too dependent on Kamara. They want him to be a luxury. Maybe that's not the best word in the passing game because he's going to catch a lot of passes. But with Mark Ingram gone, even with Latavius Murray on board, Ingram's going to be carrying the ball a lot in the running game, so you don't want to be counting on him catching 85, 90, 95 passes if you can avoid it. And they run a lot of four wide-out sets, even if one of those people or two of those people play right at running back or tight end. You don't know about Cam Meredith. He wasn't really recovered from the knee injury last year. Tre'Quan Smith and Keith Kirkwood have both shown flashes at different times, but neither one's a proven commodity. So I think there's enough uncertainty there and enough of a desire to improve the depth and lessen the burden on Kamara that they would want to add another receiver at some point. But I don't think they spend a lot of money in free agency to do that. It could be a lower round draft choice, or it could be a bargain free agent. And also, Ted Ginn is getting up there in years. He was hurt for much of last year, played fairly well when he was healthy, but I think he's a lot closer to the end than he is to the beginning. So I still think there's going to be a wide receiver in the mix who's not currently on the roster.
Les, any possibility that the Saints decide they're going to be all in for this upcoming season, that the window is going to be closing after this year, that this will be Drew's last year, and they decide to trade their 2020 pick to get back into this year's first round and maybe get some additional picks to try to just stockpile for this season. Any possibility that that happens?
I think it's possible, but I don't think it's likely. I mean, I'm sure they'll be working the phones and looking at all their options, and if there's something out there that's just too good to pass up, I think they would go ahead and do it, because I do think they're all in for this season. I think they were all in on last season, as evidenced by the trade to get Marcus Davenport. So, you know, I think they're definitely looking at that window closing, this possibly being Breeze's last season. And so they're going to be all in, whether or not that manifests itself in a major trade that might happen on draft day or some other time, just depends on the particulars. I think it's more likely that something like that doesn't really come about, but I think they're definitely all in on this year and looking at all options to maximize their chances of winning the Super Bowl this year, because it may be their last best opportunity for a while.
Talking to Les East of CrescentCitySports.com. One more Saints question before we switch over to the Pels, Les. It's been announced that teams are going to be able to submit their four greatest plays based on fan voting to celebrate the 100th anniversary. For you, for the Saints, I know for us, I think it's, for me, it's the Holy Trinity. It's the Porter pick six in the Super Bowl. It's Dempsey's kick, and it's Gleason's block. And then it's a selection of all other plays, including the Jacksonville miracle and ambush, the onside kick in the Super Bowl. For you, if you had to pick one play, your one favorite play in Saints history, what would it be?
Wow, just picking one is pretty difficult. You know, when you're looking at four, I think you have to put John Gilliam's kickoff return in there, and you have to put Garrett Hartley's field goal and NFC championship in there as well. But if you're only going to pick one play, I think it's probably going to be the Tracy Porter pick six in the Super Bowl. That's the play that essentially clinched the only Super Bowl championship in Saints history. I think that's got to be number one. But, boy, for sentimental reasons, it's hard to pass up a Gleason play.
Yeah, I think it's tough. I agree with you. I think it's tough not to try to not go with the Gleason play there because – of what it meant to the city and him being back, the team being back and then him making that play. Let's switch over to the Pels for just a few seconds here, Les. They announced that Drew Holiday did have to have surgery. It's like a hernia surgery. That's what they used to call it, sports hernia surgery, and he's going to be out. But he'll be back fully healthy for next season. We expected that. Tell me, though, a little bit about the Pels. Once again, they showed great effort and grit, and once again, they're doing it with guys. They did it last night again with guys that are getting off the scrap heap, guys that are bench players or G League guys that are getting considerable amount of minutes and yet are performing well. What do you think of the effort that the Pels are giving night in and night out? They may not be executing the best, 24 turnovers last night, but what do you think about the effort that they're giving and that Alvin Gentry is able to get out of this group?
Yeah, I don't think anybody can really question their effort overall. And I think Gentry deserves some of that credit along with the players. You know, you have mostly young players who are hungry and they're trying to prove themselves and get a foothold on an NBA career. Now, in the cases of Elfrid Payton and Julius Randle, you're looking at young veterans who are trying to drive up their market price in free agency, whether they wind up here or somewhere else. And then you have a lot of young guys. You know, we talked about Frank Jackson a lot, who had to go into the concussion protocol last night. We don't know if he'll play tomorrow against Sacramento or not, but he's had six or seven straight double-figure games, had 20 points last night before he left. So you have a lot of young guys who are trying to prove that they deserve to stick around the NBA for a while. So there's a tremendous amount of individual incentive for these guys, and that's why you're seeing them play hard. Like you said, the execution isn't always the best, and I'm not sure they're always as team-oriented as you would like them to be, because so much of the motivation right now is individually driven. But I think they are trying to have some team success as well. And you can't really fault the effort, but the results, 9 losses in 10 games, speak to the fact that they just don't have a lot of talent right now, and they're periodically running into teams that are either fighting for playoff positioning, or in the case of the Atlanta Hawks, you have a team with a lot of young talent that seems to be finding some confidence here of late. They just beat Utah and Philadelphia before they came in here last night. So I don't know. They may be able to beat the Lakers on Sunday because the Lakers are dead in the water. But I'm not seeing a whole lot of opportunities to add to the wins and losses, but you've got to give the young guys credit for the way they're fighting.
Les, we'll wrap it up with this last final question, and I'll give credit to one of your fellow scribes there at Crescent City Sports. He had kind of tweeted this out, David Grubb, about Julius Randle's lack of effort when it comes to rebounding. He had 9 double-doubles in the last 31 games, but he had 20 in the first 37, and his rebounding average was around 9 and 10 the first 3 months of the season, and it's plummeted down to 7 and now under 7 in March. He's not dealing with an injury. What's going on with Julius Randle lack of rebounding?
Well, I think there are probably a few factors. I think probably the gas tank is running a little bit low. This is the guy who was injured some, and at times the Lakers didn't know how to utilize him. I think the wear and tear on him this season is the greatest he's ever experienced. So he's probably running out of gas a little bit. You know, I do think that there have been times that the effort hasn't been what you would like it to be. And that may be fatigue driven to some degree. Maybe he's working so hard to score points that he's not working as hard to grab rebounds. And I think when Anthony Davis isn't on the floor, which is more often than not these days, he's getting more attention from the other team because he's generally the best player, certainly the best inside player on the court when Davis isn't out there. So I think it's probably a combination of those factors, but I do think he's probably feeling the effects of the most grueling season he's had in his young career.
Les, appreciate you giving us the insight as always, my friend. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll talk to you next one.
Okay, thanks, Raymond.
Les East, Crescent City Sports, breaking down Saints and Pels talk for us. When we come back here on the Wrap Game with RP3, we're going to wrap things up for this Hump Day edition right here on 103.7 The Game. Want to thank our guests today. We had a hell of a show here on this Hump Day edition of the Wrap Game with RP3 with your host, Raymond Parch III. I want to thank the voice of the LSU Tigers, Chris Blair, for coming on, giving us his time. I want to thank Ron Higgins from Tiger Details, and of course, our good buddy Les East from Crescent City Sports. Just to give you a heads up, tomorrow we got another jam-packed show for you. We'll have John Marquez on from the Town Talk and the TownTalk.com columnist. We'll also have Connor O'Gara from Saturday Down South helping us talk NCAA tournament. We'll also have Amy Just already going to be in the nation's capital right before LSU's practice from NOLA.com. Tom speaking in. She's going to help us preview the LSU-Michigan State Sweet 16 matchup. And then we'll also have Rebecca Toback, who works now for Post Game. She's going to give us some NFL talk as well. It's going to be a tremendous show, so you got to make sure to tune in from 6 to 9 tomorrow. But before we get out of here today, Cody, we gave the people not one, not two, but three. That's
oh,
right.
Yeah.
Three exciting Twitter poll questions.
Know your rules of three.
Know your rules of three. Tell the people once again what the Twitter poll questions are and what the results are. How are we doing on the voting?
We started with wanting to know if the NFL rule change allowing pass interference and no calls to be reviewed, if that takes the sting away a little bit from that Saints loss last season. 39 votes in, 77% still say no. We also asked if that players-only meeting that the LSU baseball team had last night, is that going to provide the team with a much-needed spark? We've only got 21 votes so far on that one, but 76% say no.
No.
They say no.
I would beg to differ, Acadiana.
And then finally, we asked you what the best play in Saints history is. We have the Tracy Porter pick six, the Steve Gleason rebirth block punt, Tom Dempsey 63-yard field goal, and we even gave you an other choice in there if you want. Right now, 55 votes already in on this. 64% are going with the pride of Port Allen, Tracy Porter, and his pick six. 27% say Steve Gleason.
I think those are going to be your two, right? Those are going to be your two. That's going to be a photo finish, Porter. But then Gleason, man, the emotion that night watching that live. Woo!
Green Day in the house.
Yeah. Hey, you can still vote all day today on the Twitter poll questions. Let your friends know. We'll recap. We'll give the final results on tomorrow's jam-packed show. Y'all be safe out there. Try to not to be messy. Okay? Y'all be nice to each other. Okay? If you get angry about something, just let it go. It does no good to stay angry. Up next, the Dan Patrick Show, DP and the Danettes. Coming up after that, the Jim Rome Show. We'll talk to you guys tomorrow.